optimal minimal.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
This episode is brought to you by Thrive Market. Thrive Market saves me a ton of money, and it's perfect for these crazy times. Thrive Market is a membership-based site on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. You can regularly save 25 to 50% off of normal retail prices with member-only prices for anything you can imagine, really, whether it's keto, paleo, gluten-free, vegan, whatever. You can sort by that. You can find all types of food. You can find supplements. You can find non-toxic home products, clean wine, dog food, just about anything. And let me give you a personal example of just how much you can save. So my last order, I ordered Primal Kitchen mayonnaise, which is made with avocado oil. It's delicious. Justin's almond butter. And the first was 25% off. The Justin's almond butter was 30% off. Rao's homemade marinara sauce, which is awesome, 26% off. All said and done, at the end of my shopping, I saved $39 on my order. So members, and I'm a member, can earn wholesale prices every day and save an average of $30 on each order. I'll come back to that. And through Thrive Gives, their one-on-one membership matching program, every paid Thrive Market membership is matched with a free one for a low-income family in need. So go to thrivemarket.com/Tim today to give Thrive Market a try. You can select the membership model that best fits your lifestyle. They have 1 month and 12-month membership options. Choose a free gift up to $22 in value when you join today and purchase the one-year membership. And just remember, Thrive Market membership is risk-free. You can take the first 30 days to decide if Thrive Market is right for you. If it's not, just cancel within those 30 days and get a full refund. This is what I offered my mom. So again, that's thrivemarket.com/Tim. By the way, my mom kept using it. thrivemarket.com/Tim. Check it out. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. Small businesses have unique needs. A lot of you know this. I know this. And even with the uncertainty these days, one thing stands unchanged, and that is the importance of having the right people on your team. But hiring can be hard. It can be really expensive if you make mistakes, very painful if you get it wrong. I've certainly had that experience, and I'm not eager to repeat it, so I try to do as much upfront screening as possible. When your business is ready to make the next hire, LinkedIn Jobs can help you screen candidates with the hard and soft skills that you're looking for. They'll match your position with qualified members so that you can find the right person quickly. Using LinkedIn's active community of more than 690 million professionals worldwide, LinkedIn Jobs can help you find and hire the right person faster. So when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/Tim. Again, that's linkedin.com/Tim to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multi-mineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com slash TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS. This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self-experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5 Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free. It's always going to be free. And you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5 Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company. It's a lot of fun. 5 Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5 Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you. Well, hello, boys and girls, ladies and germs. This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to another episode of The Tim Ferriss Show, where it is my job to attempt to deconstruct world-class performers of all different types to tease out the habits, thought processes, best practices, creative flow, process, etc., that you can apply to your own lives. My guest today is Sia. You can find her on Twitter at Sia, S-I-A. Sia is one of the most fascinating people I have come across in the last few years. So unorthodox, gets away with so much, and is the inveterate experimenter. I find her fascinating. She is an Australian singer, songwriter, director, screenwriter, and pop icon. Her current single, Together, is from her forthcoming album and motion picture Music, due out later this year, 2020. Last year, she partnered with Diplo and Labyrinth to form the group LSD. Their debut album, Labyrinth, Sia, and Diplo Present. LSD has 1 billion plus streams to date. She released the Grammy-nominated This Is Acting in 2016 to much critical acclaim and cemented her role as one of today's biggest stars and sought-after live performers with her sold-out Nostalgic for the Present headline tour. She has more videos in YouTube's Billion Views Club than any other female on the planet. Her massive single, Cheap Thrills, was a multi-format global radio hit and was one of the longest-running singles at Top 40 of 2016. Along with her own successes, Sia has written global smashes, and we're talking 100-plus songs, for today's biggest acts, including Beyoncé, Kanye West, Rihanna, Britney Spears, Katy Perry, and many, many more. She's really polymath. She has worked on herself. She has saved herself in more ways than one. Once again, you can find her on Twitter at Sia, Instagram at Sia Music. And without further ado, please enjoy a very wide-ranging conversation with Sia. I'd like to start in a weird place because, like you,
before you press record, I was like, you were telling me that I had, if I wanted, I could edit anything if I had felt embarrassed about what I said or something like that.
Of course.
And you very mm-hmm. very kindly, and I said, so I could do this interview on ketamine.
It's true. You absolutely could.
If only I'd known.
And if only you'd known. And, you know, as I said when you mentioned that, speaking as someone who may or may not have experience with ketamine, that you often sound better to yourself than you do to other people.
Well, I actually do get ketamine infusions from my chronic pain.
Oh, you do?
So But in LA, they do it where you're totally out. So you don't feel, you're not lucid at all, and you don't have
really
the trip at all. But here in this other place where I'm at right now, trying to maintain some modicum of privacy, they're more east meets west. So it's a doctor, and they do the infusion, but they also do like a sort of intention, and yeah, they hit the metal bowl and say, "What's your intention?" Like, well, want the pain to turn from red to blue, or blah blah blah. And that, I actually had lucid experiences, and that as a sober woman has been really fascinating.
I imagine so. I did a sequence of 5 intravenous ketamine infusions over the span of 2 weeks because I had read about its application to suicidal ideation and chronic pain separately.
Yep.
And wanted to have the firsthand experience, not because I was suicidal, but because to recommend it to anyone who might come to me with suicidal ideation, I wanted to have the firsthand experience to see what the effects and side effects were like at different dosages. And I found it to have a very surreal dissociative effect, just subjectively. What I didn't expect, because I wasn't thinking about it for the chronic pain, I had this acute pain in my mid-back, this neurological pain that had plagued me for years. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed a few weeks after ending the ketamine, no pain in my mid-back. It was near miraculous.
It's
what
incredible.
What has been your experience, and what?
Yeah, that's my experience too. And I mean, that was my experience even when I wasn't doing in LA, when I was doing it not lucidly. And then as a sober woman doing it lucidly, that was very confronting. And I thought I was going to have a bad trip. I'm a bad tripper. I'm like, I've never had a good trip. Anytime I did acid, it was bad. I'm a bad tripper. Make sure you give me lots of Versed, which is like a sedative. And then he explained to me that the more Versed he gave me, the more ketamine he would have to give me. And that if he could give me less Versed, he could give me less ketamine, and that would be nicer for my body. And so he ended up giving me half the dose that I get in LA, but he also gave me half the dose of Versed. And I had just a wonderful time. I just had a wonderful time. I was like, he writes down everything you say. And so afterwards, he was like, okay, so here we go. Here's the things that you said. Here's the things you said. I am a microbe. Am I upside down? Am I upside down? Oh, okay. Am I dying? Oh, okay, I'm not dying, because they'll lift the earphones off, because they've got theater wave music and stuff going on in your ears and stuff, and they'll say, "No, Sia, you're not dying. You're just focus on your intention." And with the one in LA, I would never wake up or even be conscious enough to know or to say, "Am I dying?" And so I found it quite. I, as someone who has had suicidal ideation, what worked for me actually was Prozac in the end. I hadn't tried ketamine for that, but I did. I had complex PTSD. I believe I may have gotten through it in the last 3 years. I've done so much painful work, but yeah, I barely left the house, and I would only go to Yeezy's Sunday service, because I love the singing so much, and I fell in love with the Kardashians. They're so nice, and I felt safe around them. It was such an interesting experience. And so I would stay at home mostly, and I have a projector that projects television or movies, whatever, onto the ceiling, and I above my bed. And so I basically just lie prone. And is that the word, prone?
Yeah, that would be, let me think about this. Prone, supine, I believe prone. I believe you got it right. Is that right? I think prone might be stomach down, like if you're in a prone position. In any case, you're on your bed on your back.
I'm on my bed on my back with my face up. Looking at this enormous projector screen. pretty much 16 hours a day for 3 years and only leave the house on Sundays to go to the Sunday service and sing my heart out and clap and dance and dance around. And I was having a lot of suicidal ideation and because of this chronic pain and because I guess I have an attachment injury and I'm really into attachment theory. And so, but I believe I may have earned secure attachment, which is going to mean nothing to so many of your listeners. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about attachment theory if anybody's interested. I think it's the cutting edge of it's based on science, and it's the cutting edge of where psychology is going and should be going is attachment theory, and it's pretty new.
Well, let's talk about it because I've had a book recommended to me a number of times. I've not read it. Fortunately for me, I have a girlfriend who synthesized it for me, but the book Attached.
Oh, yeah.
And well, I believe
wrong stuff in there. That's the only reason I don't recommend it. It also just refers to you. It's like it's the baby version. So, yes, as a baby, you're either ambivalent, avoidant, or preoccupied. But as we grow, we develop these strategies that happen in the first 10 months of our life. Based on the care that we're given, we develop one of five strategies and sometimes disorganized, all of them, like maybe all five. So the strategies are dismissive, preoccupied, fearful, avoidant, which is now called disorganized, unresolved, and secure. Which nobody in Hollywood is. Actually, that's not true. I think John Legend might be secure. He's so nice. But yeah, there's so I took an AAI, which is called an Attachment Assessment Inventory. I send it off to Harvard, and they, you know, there's like three people that work in that department, and they study the interview. And the language and the tone, because it's recorded as well. And then they report back this attachment theory, which is started by John Bowlby in the 40s or something. And then, but really only came to light in 1984 or 85. I can't remember. I'll say a lot of wrong things here.
That's okay. That's what show notes are for. Don't worry.
But I do know that in the first 10 months of your life, you are basically told who you are and what to experience in the world and how to behave and how to respond in any situation. It all happens in the first 10 months of your life based on the care that you're given. So I was complexly disorganized. When I met George Haas, who has been helping me with my attachment repair. And I mean, I'm so excited because I'd got one of my son has had an attachment assessment interview, and he was less complexly disorganized than me. And I was so happy for him because I've actually managed to like earn some secure categories. So there's different categories. There's like seven categories. I don't know what they are. I'm not that smart. But I just know that I have two left on me that aren't secure, that are both fear-related, the last time I took an attachment. But I started with only one secure feature, so out of seven. And now I have five.
Seems like a big improvement.
Yeah. So and also I guess I should say that attachment injury is addiction. It causes addiction. It's not in a genetic disorder. It's not a disease. It's an attachment injury that occurred in the first 10 months of your life. And that doesn't mean your parents were bad or mean or cruel. They may have been benignly neglectful, or maybe their dog died the day that you were born. Or, you know, there's so many reasons why your primary caregiver may have been preoccupied or unable to care for you, unable to give you the things that you needed for your brain to develop properly, securely. So, yeah, it was about 50%, I think, of the population is secure. That's if you take out poverty, and then otherwise it's about 30%.
How have you found studying attachment theory, doing the assessment, doing the work has impacted your life? I mean, it seems like you've certainly made a study of it and taken it seriously. What are the outcomes that you've seen in your life, or the changes?
Well, I'm not afraid anymore. I've spent my whole entire life being extremely afraid. And it's especially in personal relationships, interpersonal relationships. I've had the attachment strategy that I have had was, you know, previously called fearful avoidant, and now it's called disorganized. And I was complexly fearfully avoidant. And what that means is that the care was inconsistent. So you just don't know what you're going to get. So you keep turning around and putting your arms out. If you imagine a toddler, so you put your arms out and you say, maybe this time they'll pick me up. No, okay, maybe this time. And you keep imagining it, toddler turning around and putting their arms in the air, and maybe they'll get kicked in the chest, or maybe they'll get picked up. You never know. And, you know, so there's just I mean, not saying that my parents kicked me in the chest, that's an extreme analogy or metaphor. What is it? Is it an analogy or a metaphor? I don't know, a parallel.
Well, it depends, I guess, if they literally kick you in the chest or not. So since they didn't, I guess.
I don't think they kicked me in the chest. I'm pretty sure they did. But, you know, you just like, or if they didn't come when you cried. If they didn't come, there's these seven stages, like a baby, right? So the baby looks cute. First thing it does when it wants, it needs something, or it's in pain, or it needs to eat, or it needs its nappy changed, or it's uncomfortable, is it first thing it does is it looks cute. And the second thing it does is when that doesn't work to get the attention of the caregiver, they look confused. And then they'll whimper. And then they'll, they'll intermittently cry. I think that's what's next. And then that's when you should definitely pick them up, when they're intermittently crying. Then the next one will become crying. And then next one is tantrum, this full screaming, like anger, rage, like why is nobody coming to get me? And then the baby's brain goes into complete limbic shutdown because it thinks it's going to die. So people who sleep train their babies who think that it works. Yeah, it works because your baby thinks it's going to die and it gives up on life and stops crying. So it only works if you go back in there at that intermittent crying point. And if you go in when they're intermittent crying and you say, I love you, baby's name, let's say George. I love you, George. But it's time to go to sleep now, but we're just right out here. And that creates object constancy, which it makes for way less psychos in the world. And way less like, you know, people like waiting by the phone, waiting for the text. So what happens to people who didn't get picked up during the intermittent crying phase, or didn't get like just at least reassured during the intermittent crying phase? If they were left and they got into the limbic shutdown, now as adults, when someone that they're has captured their projection, like a person, like a partner, like a love interest or something, a person of great interest to you, captures your projection and you text them, and then if they don't text you back, you start to feel sick and panicky. And what's actually happening is just the same thing as when you're a baby. It was the seventh stage of limbic shutdown. So all the same neurochemicals that were dumped into your body when you're a baby and you thought, I'm going to die because nobody's coming, that happens as an adult. The same exact same brain chemistry happens. And so all these human adults are, you know, sitting at home waiting for a text, feeling like they're going to die. Like, there's so many of them, and it's like, you know, it's not everybody. Secure people don't feel that way, but people who are preoccupied or disorganized, fearfully avoidant, they do, and they suffer greatly because of it. And it's merely because nobody came and reassured them at the intermittent crying point when they were a baby that they're okay, it's time to go back to sleep now. Then they leave the room. Then the baby, if it does a thing, it does a cry, you know, the cute, confused whimper, intermittent cry. Then they go in, reassure them again. Then time to go to sleep, George. And if you do that, that's actually healthy sleep training, as long as you do that at the intermittent crying part. But if you leave a baby to cry, just cry it out, you're damaging them forever and ever. And actually, you're creating an addict without knowing.
Well, let me ask, if I could, just because you mentioned you're talking about upbringing, you're talking about, on some level, it seems like, you know, unpredictability as a factor, that's one of the factors that might lead to this fearful, avoidant, now just disorganized complex of sorts. Could you speak to, in the course of doing homework for this conversation, I came across a discussion of, and this is not to pin everything on a single parent or either both parents, but mm-hmm. your dad having two different personalities with two different names. Could you speak to this?
Yeah, he had his real name is Phil, but he had a bad temper sometimes. And when he would have his bad temper, he would seemingly turn into a different person. And then he would come back from being angry and he'd be like, sorry about that. Sorry about Stan's behavior. Sorry about that, darling. Sorry about that. And so, you know, when I grew up, I thought, watching all the movies, I thought, he has multiple personality disorder. And finally, when I was 25, I thought everyone's dad had two personalities until I was like 25. But then I realized that, no, I don't know whether it was, and it's now called dissociative identity disorder. It's not called multiple personality disorder. It's also misrepresented hugely in the media because nobody who has multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, which is what it's called now, DID, is dangerous or mean or angry. Well, actually, they can be angry, but they're all basically parts of a constellation of an abused child that have split off to protect the original soul, like from the abuser. So they're all there just simply as protectors. So when we watch movies like Split, we sort of demonize people with DID. And I also now think, I don't know if my dad had DID. I think maybe he was just smoking too much weed or, you know, I don't know. I really don't know now, but we've talked about it. I asked him recently, we had a really good rapport. I asked him recently because he mentioned Stan in a text message. And I said, hey, Dad, when you talk about Stan, what happens to me is that I get a whole bunch of fearful neurochemicals that dump into my body. And it makes me super anxious and then I get shaky. And it takes me about at least 20 minutes for my liver to be able to process it all. And could you do me a favor and could we never talk about Stan ever again? And he said, yes. And then he wrote a really beautiful message that was something like, I'm sorry, that must have been really painful for your fragile young psyche. And I'm ashamed and embarrassed.
Wow.
And I'm sorry. And that was such a powerful moment. And then he sent me a picture of him standing by my crib when I was born. Mm. And I was like, I burst into tears. It was like,
wow.
It was that he was showing me the father that he'd wanted to be, you know? And
yeah.
And so I can't, but I believe he was my primary caregiver. I don't really know. I know my mum got really depressed after I was born because she had previously lost a baby and she got postnatal depression. And so I think some of that, the depression, so if you have a blank face when you're staring at your baby, it's really scary to them, just so you know, people. It's really, and I didn't know that, but apparently if you got a blank face when you're staring at your baby, it's really scary to them. That to be animated is really helpful to them, and showing delight is really helpful, and they need your baby needs eye contact for the first 10 months from 6 to 12 inches from their face. They need eye contact, love, delight, hugs, and just love and attention, you know? And then you end up with a secure baby. But you can also smother them and then you'll get a preoccupied.
Yeah, gotta find the Goldilocks approach. I want to mention before I lose the observation that the delivery you just recounted to your dad, that phrasing seemed to be a really good use of textbook nonviolent communication.
The way you
phrased it was sort of textbook, not in a bad way. I mean, it really.
I did watch it. It was 6 hours. I watched
Marshall. I'm blanking on his last name.
The nonviolent communication guy.
Yeah. It's very subtle and very powerful when it's used well, which it sounds like you did when you spoke to your dad in a way, avoiding the type of or mitigating the likelihood of somebody having a really strong defensive response.
Right? I guess I learned if you say I feel, and then at the end you say what do you think, or you say well this is what makes me feel. This is how it makes me feel, or if I use science, which I'm getting smarter at now in terms of neurochemistry and the brain and pain and psychology, and also, you know, parenting and attachment parenting and that sort of stuff. I just am so in love with it because it's going to create I want to help people create secure babies so that we have so many less people, you know, in pain.
And it seems like one way or a very important way of doing that is working on yourself, right? And I just want to provide a little bit of context here for people who are listening. And that is, I've loved your music, both the music where you are a performer and then the music unknown to me oftentimes. Has been written by you. It's really astonishing how many songs I have on playlists that when I finally had my, my Kobayashi, like Kaiser Sose moment, and I was like, oh my God, like it's everywhere. Sia's work is ever in my life.
I'm like cobwebs, babe.
So that's part one. And then a reader of mine named Brian Elliott recommended, after I wrote a blog post on a lot of the downsides of being public-facing and having an audience, recommended a profile of you called How Sia Saved Herself, which was in Rolling Stone.
Pharrell wrote that.
That's right. And it completely captured my imagination and talked about many of the decisions you've made, which, to borrow some phrasing that I've heard you use, has allowed you to use your gifts without hurting yourself, right? Without just destroying your serenity. And we're going to talk about that. Yeah. I just wanted to give that story because how Sia saved herself. I think in order to save your kids, whether even if they haven't been born yet, it's important to work on yourself. But you're clearly doing and have done a lot of that. I want to ask you this was where the I want to start somewhere weird came up a while back.
Yeah.
And it relates, well, it makes me think of a novel that really caught my imagination when I was a young kid, and that was Around the World in 80 Days. And I thought, well, maybe I'll start with Around the World of Sia in 80 Tattoos. You have quite a few tattoos. I wanted to ask about a few of them.
Okay.
And I haven't seen all of these. I've just read about a few of them. So tell me if they're not accurate. But do you have a tattoo that says don't think?
Yeah. That was before I actually got into meditation and realized that the irony of that tattoo. Because telling yourself not to think is thinking.
Yeah, right. Don't think of the pink elephant. Don't think of the pink elephant.
Yeah, so I realized, so for all your listeners who don't meditate, meditation is just a practice. It's nothing fancy. It's just breathing. It's like you could just, if you can just breathe and feel the air going in your nose and out your nose, like, and count to 10 and just feel, be present with that feeling of the air touching your nostrils and do that, that's a practice. And then if you have a thought, that's okay. And it takes you away, like in a car, like say you get in the car with the thought and it takes you for a drive, that's okay. Just when you realize, just go, oh, whoops, and go back to one and start counting from one again. And that's practice. It's just concentration practice. And then there are all sorts of other practices that you can sort of like delve into after that. But it is just even just concentration practice is so good for your brain and so good for your heart and your spirit. And it, the thing is when I hear people say, oh, I can't meditate, I'm not good at it, there is no being good at it because it's a practice. You can't be bad at it, actually. The only way of being bad at it is not doing it. My George Haas is my meditation teacher. And there's periods where I've gotten extremely low over the last 3 or 4 years. And there were periods where I totally dipped out on meditating. And if he'd come over, I'd be crying, I'd be whatever, like super, super suicidal, whatever. And he'd come over and he'd go, have you thought about meditation? It's free. There's data that says that it will help you. And I'll be like, fuck off, George. And oh, how we laughed.
What does your practice look like? The mutual friend who introduced us when we finally started communicating directly has a TM practice, right? So I'm sure does many other things, but has a transcendental meditation practice, 20 minutes twice a day.
Yeah.
I don't want the first to be done.
But I don't think you should have to pay for meditation. And also, I know the secret. I know what they do, and I'm sure you do too. That, you know, your mantra is just related to your age. And I think if anything helps you, do it. And if that's what you found, and great, and it helps you, then do it. But I don't believe that meditation should be paid for. I don't believe that it's anything you can be given. I think that it should be a dana process and that it should be by donation only. That's just my personal opinion. Because
what does your practice look like?
Oh, so my mind is just like about like probably 20 minutes a day. I will either listen to George's podcast at least once a week. I listen to George's podcast, which is, I think, Meta Group. George Haas, I don't know, attachment fair, something.
I'll find it.
Find it, put it in the links. But it's very heady. I've said to him recently, George, you need to do like an attachment repair for dummies because anyone I send to your podcast, that it's really hard for them to understand. It's really heady. And it did take me 2 or 3 years to understand it myself. And that's with him repeating himself for 3 years over and over again.
Yeah. It's meditation times attachment. Meditation X attachment with George Haas, HAAS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, okay, my practice looks like this. Well, I'll do concentration practice where I count, or I'll do, so Shinzen is George's teacher. So I guess I'm using Shinzen's model. And that model is also like I do off. It's feel in, feel out, so you can, like, what you're feeling in your body or what you can feel on the outside of your body, or hear in, hear out is what you can hear inside your head or what you can hear outside of your head, exterior noise, like external noise. And then there's see in and see out, so that's, like, visual imagery or you can look at a leaf and watch it just wave. And the best one for me is hear out, so that's what I do. And I think that's the best one for people who have extreme, like, complex trauma, because it's externalizing in a way and keeps you grounded in the present moment. So right now, let's say, okay, I'm meditating right now. So I'm listening to the sound of my air conditioner and the sound of your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's here out. And then when I get carried away with a thought, I just come back to hear out. That's what I do. So hear out is the one that I find the most easy, which is just focusing on all the noises around me externally that are in this perceived reality.
Just a quick thanks to one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back to the show. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is inevitably Athletic Greens. I view it as my all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it in 2010 in the 4-Hour Body, and I did not get paid to do so. I've used it ever since. Developed from a complex blend of 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, Athletic Greens is a greens powder engineered to help fill the nutritional gaps in your diet. So I always try to do things through whole foods, but this covers my bases. Right now, Athletic Greens is offering you their vitamin D3 K2 liquid formula free with your first purchase. Two vital nutrients for a strong immune system and strong bones. So simply visit athleticgreens.com/Tim to claim this special offer today and receive the free D3 K2 bundle with your first purchase. That's up to a 1-year supply of vitamin D as added value when you try their delicious and comprehensive all-in-one daily greens product. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Tim.
Let me take a leap to something that I think is possibly related. You have written more than 100 pop songs for people like Beyonce, Britney Spears, and Rihanna, whose Diamonds hit number one, and so much more. I mean, the list is extremely long. You have, of course, then so much of your own work in the performative sense on top of that. And what people might not realize is some of your songs that, and this has a personal meaning to me because this one has been on my playlist maybe the longest, and that is Breathe Me.
Mm.
The night you wrote that, you tried to kill yourself with 22 Valium and a bottle of vodka.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk about that. And the question is, because I heard you on, for instance, Howard Stern in 2014, and around the 16-minute mark, if people are interested, you play back a recording of coming up with the, I guess it was maybe the melody and some of the lyrics for Diamonds, which everybody would recognize.
Yeah.
And you sounded like you were almost channeling, because you're kind of mumbling nonsense syllables and then it just fell into place.
That's how it is for me, and that's how it is for Labyrinth, and that's how it is for, I think, Eddie Benjamin, who's going to be the next Justin Bieber. But it's just like a form of channeling, and like words, sounds sort of come out, and then sometimes, if you're lucky, well, the melody is pure channeling. And then the lyrics, if you're lucky, also will come out. That's awesome when that happens, when that accidentally happens. That's then I think I'm really getting out of the way of, you know, and that I'm allowing it to just flow through. But yeah, for me, it's just getting out of the way, and just trusting in the present moment that what I do next is going to be what is supposed to happen.
So I'm going to ask a whole bunch of questions about process, because I know my listeners love process. I love process.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch of questions. The overarching question is, and the reason I asked about the taking of the drugs and the vodka and so on, is you seem to me to be very sensitive. That is, and not in a bad way.
This means
that as an empath, it's like if you were a scale, you wouldn't just be a body weight scale. You'd be like a jewel scale, where you have a lot of sensitivity. And
I wonder, highly sensitive person.
Yeah, and so I wonder how much of the drug use and the suicidal ideation and so on is from an overwhelm of input. Or is it from other things? I'd just love to hear you speak to that.
It's interesting that you ask, because I always just figured, oh, it's because I something wrong with me. I'm broken. It's my early trauma, or I'm an addict, or I'm just like, I don't belong in this world. I don't know why I'm here. what's, you know, I'm just different. I feel like an alien. I don't know how people will be happy. I just didn't have the right chemicals in my brain going on. And that was just, I now know, due to the first 10 months of my life. But I didn't know that then. And so I attributed it to all sorts of whatever I could, really. I'd just try and attach it to anything and be like, that's why I'm like this. Or this is why I'm like, oh, that's why I'm like this. And certainly that night that I wanted to die, you know, I can just remember just wanting to die, like just thinking I was so broken that nobody could fix me. And then waking up in the hospital and feeling very embarrassed because you can't commit suicide with Valium, you can commit sleep. And, you know, like a pussy because I think I must have called people. Like, I don't remember, but I must have called people because obviously someone came and took me to the hospital. So, you know, there's always been a part of me that wanted to live. And I think the part of me that I wanted to kill was the part of me that was in pain and not the real me, not the real actual me who has levity and has found levity. I've always had some levity, but I also had that extreme sensitivity and I had some, yeah, just chemical issues in my brain. Just I didn't have the right biochemistry going on. So I had like a broken, what's the frontal one called? Frontal cortex?
Prefrontal cortex?
Yeah, that one. Broken prefrontal cortex. Yeah, that one. I had that. That was broken. And so I was just, the suicidal ideation was just, it was like a broken record going on in my brain. It was actually, it's actually a way to regulate emotion. So I would feel extreme sadness. There was this idea that if I killed myself, I had power over it. So
sure.
If that I could stop the pain, but what I was afraid of was dying as well. it was such a catch-22. It was like, it's a very peculiar place to be in. And then I realized, oh, I don't want to kill myself. I want to live. I have a broken brain. I've got to take medication. And as soon as I started taking medication, Prozac, I took, 6 days later, the suicidal ideation was gone, completely gone. And I was sad for myself that I hadn't done it sooner.
Yeah.
I'd had that broken brain for so long that thought that there was something just very, very wrong with me. So I can't even remember the question you asked, but that answer?
You know, my questions are really intended as prompts. They're not, so it was more intended to open up what just came out. So yes, you did answer it. And what you said makes me think about a phrase or an expression that I heard from someone named Stanislav Grof, who is a famous Czech-born psychotherapist who's done a lot of work with LSD-assisted psychotherapy, mm-hmm. developed something called holotropic breathwork also as a substitute. But he's been on the podcast. He was on at age 85 or 86. But one of the things that he's written about is the desire to kill oneself being a desire to kill the ego, but the only form that most people recognize for doing that is killing the physical body.
Yeah.
And that there are other approaches, right? There are prescription options in some cases. Ketamine is particularly, and I was very grateful I went through my testing of ketamine because literally 2 or 3 weeks later, a friend of mine reached out who's a police officer who was suicidal and he had battled depression. And really, the suicidal ideation was, I think, in part because he had these loops that he could not interrupt, these endless loops, and he just wanted to stop the loops.
It's usually PTSD that causes those loops, the broken prefrontal cortex.
And ketamine is, I would view it, not to belabor ketamine, but I just for people who may be hurting out there and at the end of their rope, ketamine is not additive in my experience, like some other compounds. Let's just say psilocybin in looking at treatment-resistant depression, I think is more additive, but it is subtractive in the sense that it hits pause on these loops and it allows you to experience yourself without the loop. And I think that you then can have the type of realization you did 6 days later saying, oh,
I am a microbe.
Why didn't I do this? I'm a microbe. I am upside down. So let's, if we could, and I know this it doesn't have to be this example, but to talk about process, the diamonds example is a fun one, I think, because of how tightly it was done, given you had a plane to catch and a car waiting for you. But you have these expressions and you have very clear thinking around your songwriting. And I've heard you talk about strong titles and the ability to Google, right? In the case of Chandelier,
yeah.
Milking the metaphor. I mean, you think about this very concretely. Can you just give an example of your process?
Now it's sort of changing, but when I first started, my manager said, well, he said to me something that, was monumentally important, which was basically what I needed to be doing was be writing high concept, he was calling it. I think he was calling it high concept. I think that's what he said. Mm-hmm. And then I Googled it, and then it didn't make sense to me because it was talking about Big Brother. I was like, well, I don't get it. And I called him back, and I was like, what do you mean exactly? And he was like, well, you take something, and I was like, oh, like, hang on, do you mean like piggy bank? Like, I'm not your piggy bank? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, I think I've got it. All right. I don't want to be your piggy bank. Like, you know, and he was like, yeah, that's kind of it. Not it, but it. I was like, oh, okay. And then, like, I don't know, a week later I wrote Titanium. And that was the first one I wrote. And then so I always channel the melody, but then I was consciously writing down things that I thought would be good titles, Googleable titles, or that would be good metaphors or catchy. And so that was started to be a fun game. And so that's what I did for a long time. But yesterday I wrote a song that is just on the verge of cheesetastic. Which is, I wrote a song about New Year's Eve. It's called 3 Minutes to Midnight. So you put the song on 3 Minutes to Midnight, and then everyone can count down together. So if you just press play at 3 Minutes to Midnight, it's like, I want everyone to play the song. And it's so silly and fun. And in that one, I almost freestyled the entire thing. So, yeah, I don't know, like, some days I'm very formulaic, and some days some days people like give me very specific, you know, what they want for an end title, or, you know, of a movie, what they need, or what Rihanna's looking for at the moment, the sound she's looking for, or here's a track that she really likes, you know. So sometimes I get direction and I take it. I just take it. And if I don't work so much with artists anymore, but it was so helpful to work with artists because, like, I am really good at, like, being of service. So I could totally eat shit sandwiches all day long, like, if they were, like, divas or whatever. And because I knew I would still be getting 50% or 30% or whatever of the publishing. And if I could dissuade them from saying something extremely silly or bad, then I'd done my job. But you know, that if they wanted to sing a song about something that I found banal or stupid, or that was fine, that I'm just there to support what they're trying to do. And yeah, and I'll challenge them to some degree if it's very, very bad, but otherwise I'm just there to support them. But that was really helpful to me because of that helped me, I think, in terms of becoming a director.
Right, right. And we're definitely going to talk about that. I just want to pause, bookmark for a second.
Yeah.
For people who don't understand the peculiarities or the intricacies of the music business, And you said the percentages of publishing. Can you explain what that means for folks, just so they understand how different people make money in the music world?
Yeah, so publishing is really the only growth industry in music. I mean, touring, if you're a Coldplay, you'll make money, or U2. But touring, usually, you know, musicians will make a loss. Really the only merch, you can sometimes make money, but really the best way to make money in music, if you're going to be a musician, is to write the music. And so there's a couple of different ways. There's pop splits and there's urban splits. and I can tell you that. So I guess an urban split is like whoever's in the room, or whoever does even one tiny word or something, it all gets split between you maybe equally, I think. I think that's an urban split. But I don't do that. And it was really funny because Benny Blanco like wrote me and was like, why don't you, he's a producer. He did a bunch of Katy Perry hits, and he just writes hits galore. He stopped counting after he had 10 top number ones, you know what I mean? So anyway, he was writing me, and he was like, why are you, because he was working with a partner on producing a song. And I believe that if I write the melody in the top line, I get 50% of the song. And if you write the chords, you get 50% of the song, and do the production, you get paid for your production separately, aside from getting paid for the writing. So a good producer these days will make 30, 40 grand for producing a song. That means, producing a song means putting all of the sounds in there, all of the piano sound, and then a violin sound, or the sound of the bass and the beat. That's called production. The songwriting process is literally just chords and melody and lyrics. So chords are worth 50% of publishing. And lyrics and melody are worth 50% of publishing. And then if you go and produce it, you get a fee for producing. So I'm so lucky, I wrote the chords to Chandelier.
Can you explain what that means? Because I think chords, and I think strumming like a C or a D on a guitar, but I don't know if I'm thinking of the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's about it. Like, it's so, a chord is, I guess it's three fingers on a piano.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they make a chord. And so it'd be like the I'm doing the root note of a chord. So it'd be like that's four different, like, and they're just four different notes, but I
got it. And then you give that to the producer, they take that, they put it in, just since you mentioned the piano.
Only on the part. Chandelier. It was Chandelier I did write the chords. But I sent them to Jesse Chatkin, and I said, can you make a song out of this? And he did all the production, and I'm nice. Mm. So I gave him 25% of the publishing. But I'm not required to do that. Like, I could have taken 100% of the song and paid him his production fee of $40,000, let's say.
And melody is the sound of the voice, or the
la, 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 la. That's just the
right.
La, 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 whatever.
Right, like improv jazz. Yeah.
It's melody. And then once you add lyrics to that, it's called top line. Melody and lyric together is called top line.
Got it.
And so I am a top line writer, but I actually now, I guess I'm also can write some chords, but I'm pretty shabby at it. But I do like clang away on the piano occasionally, and send Jesse like videos of me playing the piano so he can see which chords I'm playing. And then he will build songs out of those, and because I appreciate him and I know I couldn't do it without him, I always give him 25%. But again, in another world, he wouldn't be entitled to that. He would get a production fee. So, but I like to be generous.
Yeah. And when somebody says, for instance, if you were to say, I have 50% of publishing, what is that 50% of? Is it specifically what radio stations pay?
It's across the board. It means on a really highly listened to commercial radio station, let's say, and I'm just, this is a random number that's not necessarily correct. Let's say every time Chandelier gets played, they pay my publisher $1, right? So now I get 75 cents of that and Jesse gets 25 cents of that. And my publishing company, I think they take 15% or something as an admin fee.
Yep. It's like a book agent. Yeah, 15%.
Yeah. And it used to be 30 because I used to need a publisher, but I don't actually need a publisher now because I don't need them to introduce me to any songwriters or other songwriters or artists. I don't need the services that they offer. So I only need them to collect money for me. So that's how I managed to get it down to 15%. Because most people are still paying 30% of their publishers.
So do you get paid when albums are sold digitally as well, or is that completely separate?
I do, but I don't know how. And that would be a question for my manager. I really haven't.
No problem. We don't have to.
Royalties, and I don't understand that one at all.
Now process-wise, you were talking about the volume of work that you do, and I found an interview you did with The Guardian in 2016. This is a while ago, so this may have changed, but I'd love to hear you expand on it a little bit. And here's the quote. I love the idea of how fast we can make the song, but I don't think that I'm necessarily a super talented songwriter. I just think I'm really productive. One out of 10 songs is a hit. So where a lot of people will spend 3 weeks on one song, I will write 10 in 3 weeks. Maybe the song that they sculpt is going to be as successful as just one of the 10 that I wrote. Is that still true?
Yeah, that's definitely still true. But I also think I've gotten a little bit better at picking tracks that are hits. So sometimes people send me tracks. So for the people listening, tracks are when someone, a producer, sends you a already fully done bottom line, which is all the music, all the sounds, the beat, everything, the chords, it's all there. And that's 50% right there. They send you 50% of a song. And if I hear the way the chords move and think that it's a smash, because I actually record myself to everything I listen to the very first time. So I press play when I listen to something for the first time. I press play and record on my computer, and I'll sing along to it and see if I can intuit where it's going. And if I manage to intuit where it's going and it sounds good and something works, then I'm just better at picking now what I think will be a hit or what will be catchy, because I do believe now that pop music is really just indoctrination, which is sad, because it used to be, music used to be good. Once upon a time when music was good. No, there's still great music out there, but I never hear it. Apparently. But I don't listen to music. I just watch television and movies, so that's probably why the only person I listen to is Labyrinth.
Is that true? You don't ever listen to background music?
No. Oh, yeah. I'll put into, because I just got Apple Music. I don't have Spotify or Pandora, but I just got Apple Music. And so now I just type in theta waves or beta waves or alpha wave, and I just press play on one of those, and then I'll meditate or whatever. But if I'm not watching television, I'm talking to a friend. I'm not usually listening to music. It's not what I do.
That's very interesting. Has that always been the case, or did that at some point just feel too much like work to you, or you can't listen to it without breaking it down and thinking about the top line and the this and that and the other thing?
No, it's weird. It's just, I did it very much. I was obsessive as a child around it. I would listen to, and I've said this a billion times, so apologies to those who've heard this before. But I would listen to that part in the Doors song where in a Doors song where it goes and I liked that part so much, but I just didn't care about the rest of the song, so I just recorded that part like 50 times onto a 30-minute tape, and I would literally just listen to that over and over again, and I would sing along to it. And the same with this Chrissy Hynde one, the don't get me wrong. I still can't do it. I can't do it. I've never been able to do it. And I can't do it like she does it. And I would try so hard, and I just technically could not do it, and I still can't do it. And so that's exciting because I love not being able to do something. At least because I was sort of recently thinking, oh, wow, I've met all my professional and personal goals. What do I do now? Is it nihilism or is it full engagement, you know? I guess I could still keep trying that fucking Chrissy Hynde lick. But, yeah, I was super obsessive with music as a child. I didn't have a television until I think I was 10 or 11, and then I became addicted to television. But I still listened to music, some music, not much. Usually whatever my parents were listening to. And that was like Soul to Soul and Malcolm McLaren. And, well, earlier, when my dad was around, it was all 60s, like Motown and girl groups and really just fun and pop, that sort of stuff. And then when he left, it came... I think my stepfather, I think he brought the Malcolm McLaren and the Soul to Soul into the house. And and so Karen Wheeler, Terrence Trent D'Arby, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Chrissy Hynde, and Annie Lennox sort of became these voices that I, and Mariah Carey actually, these voices I just started to mimic. I just wanted to. So the obsession for me as a child was I would mimic these artists until I thought I sounded exactly like them. So then I guess when I sang the first original song ever, that I had the voice that was an amalgamation of all of those people that I had studied. It wasn't very good. I mean, there's an amazing video of me when I'm 12, and I'm really a bad singer. And I'm definitely going to put it out sometime. I want people to know that I was no Christina Aguilera. Like, she was incredible. Like, when she was 10 years old, she's doing these insane technical runs. I was a very mediocre singer at 12, and I went on this talent show and super mediocre. I sent it to basically, this is silly, again, I'm bringing up the Kardashians, but I sent it to North because Kim told me that North got sad because Kim Kardashian told me that North got sad because she couldn't sing Chandelier as well as I did it. And I sent her the video of me when I was 12. And
that's amazing.
And I said, look at this. I couldn't sing at all when I was 12. Like, you're only little. Like, you're going to be an amazing singer. of course, they're so nice and funny, but it's pretty a hilarious video. It's like, I might have a rat's tail.
I'd love to. Oh, that makes two of us. I had a rat tail at 12 on Long Island, but I wasn't doing any singing.
I couldn't have had my legs further apart. I was always doing the splits while I was singing a song about some men have muscles. They are muscle bound and uncontrolled.
Well, I would love to see the video. So please do put that out.
I will. It's definitely, I'm definitely going to do that because I want kids to know that, you know, I don't know. I wasn't always a good singer. And I've gotten better, I think, even just over the years, last 20 years, I think. I didn't really belt. That means sing out really big loud for the listeners. I didn't really belt until I was maybe 6 years ago, 10 years ago.
Wow.
No, 10
Very
years
Very recent.
Ago. Yeah, because Break Free, yeah, was my Whisper album. I had yet to find my voice.
So you've honed your voice, and we're going to talk. I want to ask you about the movie. Before we get to the movie, I have to ask you about the decision to, at least in many cases, hide your face and get away with a lot, right? Because, and I'm reading here this piece from the Rolling Stone profile. I'll just read one paragraph and then I have a couple of other additions. But the success of Titanium, which is a whole story unto itself that we won't get into right now, but people can look up the song on Wikipedia, made Sia one of the most in-demand songwriters in the business, but she needed to put out one last album to get out of an old publishing deal. She said she'd do it on the condition that she would have artistic control and do no promotion, no touring, no press, no media appearances. All right. Now, you've also sung with your back to audiences. You've been on the cover of magazines with your face entirely covered. Why did you make these decisions?
I really can't really 100% remember the genesis, but I've got this vague recollection that I thought, all right, I'll sing with my back to the audience and I'll put this blonde bob on other people. And then everyone can be the pop star. And then I cast Maddie in Chandelier, and she was so incredible and engaging and lovable.
And does she pronounce her last name Ziegler, or how does she?
Ziegler, yeah.
Yeah, Maddie. So for people who don't know, this is an incredible dancer.
Unbelievable. And actor, by the way. She
an is actor.
Oscar worthy. It's crazy. So she was, I didn't realize, was going to be so engaging and wonderful and lovable, and that I was going to want to immediately, like, have her in my life all the time. And so I guess in the beginning you'll see there are pictures of lots of different people wearing the blonde bob in the artwork for, I think, A Thousand Forms of Fear, I think. Because originally I was just going to have other people, like, and celebrities. Like, I asked Kanye if he would just wear the blonde bob and sing my song or whatever. Or I thought, oh, well, I'll ask Robert Pattinson, or I'll ask other people if I was going to ask Robert Pattinson if he would do the cover of Rolling Stone, like if I could just put his face over my face on a stick, you know? So I had all these ideas, like it would be funny, like, to, like, hide from celebrity, or just ask other people if I could borrow their celebrity just for the day. And so that never really evolved because of my partnership with Maddie, because I fell madly in love with her as a person and as an artist and as a collaborator. And so suddenly I was just like, I don't want to work with anyone else. I love this person. She's so wonderful. And so I guess she became almost an avatar. And I know most of the tweens and little people think that she is Sia. When they meet me, they're so disappointed. And actually, often we're out, me and her together, and often people will come, and most of the time I try and bodyguard her, and I'll be like, oh, unfortunately we can't do photos right now. She's not supposed to be in town, or no one's supposed to know where she is, because it's getting gnarly for her, people wanting selfies and stuff like that now. But on the rare occasion that it's a very sweet little tiny person, they'll say, you know, oh, would you mind taking a picture? They think I'm her mum. Which I love. Because I dated a couple of celebrities, you know, over the last few years. But, like, I loved that one time I was on a date with someone and they recognized the person I was on the date with, and they were like, oh my God, could you take a picture with me and him? And I was like, of course. And so it was just so, I loved being the plus one. I was like, I would love to be a plus one. Because I like being entertaining and fun and nice and friendly to my friends, and obviously to my fans or whatever, or to you, or like, you know, people who are trying to make the world a better place. But like, I don't care about adulation from people I don't know or who, I don't know. I get my validation elsewhere. And so celebrity is this huge gaping fame is like just a huge disappointment. Like, for those of you who are listening who want to be famous, just do something else. It's not what you think it is. It's, yeah, it's toxic.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. It's not what you think it is. Yeah. Highly accurate.
Yeah. So, I don't know. But yeah, I fell in love with Maddie, and then the big wig was actually, I think my ex-husband was like, you should wear a really big wig, like an anime character. And so I did that at the Grammys, and then that became kind of, I guess, iconic. And then
yeah, I would say that.
Became a Halloween costume. And then Maddie also became a Halloween costume in Chandelier. And that was conscious. I was like, I want to always make outfits or looks that can be replicated for very little money, because I want people to be able to afford to dress up as the pop star.
So I had no idea.
Yeah, and the same with my movie. All of the outfits in the movie I'm having made for Halloween in affordably, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've alluded to the movie a few times now. Why don't we tell people more about it?
Okay.
Could you, what's the genesis story? Why do a movie?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I was very, I was about, I don't know, maybe 15, 16 years ago now. I don't know. I just had a story come into my head. I wrote it down, and then many years later, it evolved into a screenplay, and then it was a kind of mediocre, pretty good indie screenplay, but my best friend, who is a screenplay writer, he said, I mean, this is great, nice indie, you could do this. It wasn't a musical. It was pure narrative. I was very against making a musical because I really wanted people to view me as a serious director. I really thought that they'd think I was a wanker, and it would be it was just like a vanity project, or like an actor making an album, or, you know, I was scared of judgment, basically. And then he said, we could make this, I could help you with this, and we could make it better. So I started from the scratch with Dallas Clayton, and he's my best friend, the one I was talking to before I talked to you, just so I could go get some co-regulation in, because I was nervy. and it worked. 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, that's a top tip. 20 minutes of co-regulation with someone that you trust and that trusts you, that is like you have a 50-50 relationship with. 20 minutes of conversation with them will make you not want to do a drug, smoke a cigarette, gamble, have sex, porn, shop. Like, it's the cure to addiction. It's connection. 20 minutes of co-regulation with the person that you trust. That's the solution. Bill W from AA, he just sort of happened upon it, like, accidentally, I think. But now it's proven science, you know. So anyway, back to the movie. Yeah, we wrote it, and I was too scared to make it. Then some personal went through a divorce. You know, I think he wanted to put babies in me, and me not to be working so much. And I realized I was in the wrong relationship. And so that was very devastating. And that's been about a 4-year recovery from that divorce. And to help me through it, I guess Dallas, my best friend, he kept saying to me, we went and saw La La Land, and he just said to me, you could do that. And I was like, you think so? Because I loved it. And he was like, yeah, you could totally do that. And I was like, you really think so? Because I'd always directed with a partner called Daniel Askill. That's who I directed all my music videos with. So I wasn't sure if I was really a director or was I just an artist with good ideas. But it turned out Lena Dunham and Dallas, they said to me, you can do it. You can do it. We like, you'll totally be able to do it. And because of who they are to me, good friends that I trust, I guess they gave me the self-esteem that I was lacking. And so I called up Vincent Landay, who had been producing, who's produced nearly all of Spike Jonze's movies. And he's one of my favorite directors and done adaptation and Being John Malkovich. And I said, can we try again? Because we'd talked before. And he said, yes, okay. And also someone, like maybe three people had said to me, also, you're an idiot. You've got to turn it into a musical. You're such an idiot. It's like having a blank Scrabble piece and not using it. You're an idiot. And so finally, I finally caved. And, you know, and of course then the budget like went from 4 million to 16 million. And I was like, oh. So, but I did a good deal. Like I got two record labels in a bidding war. And then for my albums, and then I just said, whoever's going to lend me $16 million is who I'm going to go with.
Nice.
So that's what happened, and I love the movie. I'm proud of it. It's a beautiful film.
What's the name of the movie?
It's called Music.
Dig it.
Yeah, and that's actually Maddie Ziegler plays a character called Music, who is a teenager who's suffering severely from autism, and she's quite low functioning. She is nonverbal, although she does have echolalia, so she can repeat what you say, but she doesn't generate her own vocabulary sentences. So anyway, that was really scary for Maddie. I remember in the first day she came, I cast everyone basically off Twitter by just looking who can sing, who doesn't sing like a white like musical theater major, who could sing. So then I basically just tweeted the people I wanted in my movie, and they said yes. and then Maddie was really scared because I based the character on a guy called Stevie, who I used to sit next to in an AA meeting on Sunday mornings at the log cabin. His mother was the deaf interpreter. And so he obviously himself wasn't an addict, but he was in there with her because she couldn't afford care for him while she worked. And I fell in love with Stevie. I sat next to him, and I don't know, I fell in love with him. And I'd already had this story in my head. And so the character was always suffering from autism in my, or suffering, or I don't know, flourishing from autism, depending on how you view it. And then, yeah, when I met Stevie, I was like, oh, my gosh, like, oh, he's so beautiful and perfect, and I love him. And so I taught Maddie all of his mannerisms and his vocalizations, and she got scared. She got scared. I remember the first day that her and Kate Hudson were going to come to rehearsal, and she got there because I'd bought a house across the road for her to live in temporarily, because she was always here in town doing auditions and things like that, and I didn't think it was good for her to always be in different hotels and stuff like that. So she came over, well, across the road, and she came over and I could see something was off. And I said, what's going on? And she burst into tears, and she said, I'm just really scared. I don't want anyone to think I'm making fun of her. And she is such a sensitive, beautiful person. And I just said to her, I will never let that happen. I will not let that happen. I will, you can have final say over the cut. Like, I will never let that happen. And then we spent 3 days working on all of like Stevie's utterances and vocalizations and tics and movements. And so, yeah, I have Stevie to thank for this amazing character that you'll see in the movie. And then inside of her head takes place all of these musicals where she's unburdened by any of her, you know, physical disabilities, the tics and the pain and the, and so she is, her body is free from autism and all the associated comorbid collection of things that you can have. And everyone with autism is different, every single one. There's no two that are alike. So when we sent it off to the Child Mind Institute to make sure that we had done a good job representing the autism community, I was really hopeful that we'd done a good job. I felt proud. I thought we had. But they came back with 100% approval. And that, to me, was the day that I cried and felt relief and thought, okay, I've made a movie that's meaningful and that is interesting and moving and fun and funny. And that's what I'd wanted to do. So, you know, definitely, it's a, like, you bring your Kleenex, but, you know, you get your Hollywood, you get your Hollywood ending, so don't worry.
Congratulations. I mean, it sounds like a real...
This is the hardest thing I've ever
done. A real journey.
I think that's why I've also been in bed for 3 years.
What keeps you going? What gives you the most energy these days? I mean, you've seemingly ticked off nearly every professional accolade and success you could ever want.
Yeah, I've got no goals. What? Just being a mum. So, I just adopted 2 kids.
How did you decide to do that?
I saw one of them on an HBO. So yeah, I'll tell you, I'm so obsessed with television. That's why I'm friends with the Kardashians, like Kathy Griffin, and like my interior designer was on $1 million, like designers or whatever on Bravo. Like I'm friends with Bethany Frankel, for fuck's sake. Like I'm into television and reality TV, and I basically audition all my friends through reality TV to decide whether or not they're safe or not, and then I go and find them and ask them to be my friend. So and then I've got my regular friends, my regular circle of friends, but I'm only friends, the only celebrities I'm really friends with are reality TV stars.
Now when you say safe, that just means that they're so aware of the public and exposed to the public that nothing weird related to your fame will happen?
No, just psychologically not fucked. Like not gonna harm them. That they're just good people. Like they're good, well-meaning people.
And how do your kids, how does the adoption fit into this?
Oh, how does it? Why did I start?
You mentioned HBO somehow.
Oh yeah. That's exactly right. So I was watching a documentary on HBO, i.e. reality TV. But it was about the foster care system. And I saw a boy on there, and he was 16 at the time, and I thought, I can be his mother. And what a hilarious, like, overstatement that was. And I found him. I found him, and he was 18 by the time I found him. And I met him, and he said, can I bring my friend? He won't make it. He's too pretty.
And he's too what?
He's too pretty.
Oh, pretty.
Yep. And I said, yeah, okay, because I had 2 spare bedrooms. And I, like an absolute maniac, took them home that day. And they were both 18 at the time. And the last year has just been, you know, an absolute roller coaster, but just the most rewarding and the best thing ever. You know, like being a mummy, like a god mummy to Maddie is like, has been the most meaningful thing to me over the last, you know, six, seven years. And now being a mummy to my boys is now the most meaningful thing to me. Like, and that's all I got. That's all I got. I don't care about anything else. I just want to make sure that they don't end up in the 5% that end up you know, because they statistically should be end up in jail for murder. And with the histories that they have, the trauma histories that they have. And I want to keep that up. I want to fuck the system. I think the system is fucked. And I want to help keep them out of jail so then they could change the world.
Well, thank you for doing that. It's something that, you know, I can't even, I can't put myself in your shoes, of course. I mean, it must be such a multifaceted emotional experience. Some of my closest friends have adopted kids, and actually one woman I'm very close to had a somewhat similar situation in the sense that she and her partner were planning on adopting one child and they came home with three.
And then they wrote a movie about it.
Yeah.
Mark Wahlberg.
This one was a different couple, but similar idea, I suppose. And it's parenting, I would imagine. I don't have kids of my own, but it seems like the most rewarding and most difficult job imaginable. And all the more so, I would imagine, when you are picking up where the system has left off, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, I have a newfound, complete, like, newfound respect for all parents. Any, like, you know, I feel like I'm lucky because they have structure, but they have trauma. So my job now is to use what I've learned in my attachment repair therapy with George Haas and use that with them to create a secure base for them and to help them, their brains to, the neuroplasticity of their brains to be able to become secure as well. That's my only goal at the moment, is to help my children earn secure attachment. Because, they've been in at least 18 different homes, each of them.
Wow.
Yeah, and they've been treated abominably. And I'm just lucky I'm able to, I have the resources that I can get them the kind of help that they really need. And I'm grateful that it only took a year for me to, like, get them on board, you know?
But it's incredible.
It was a tough year.
But yeah, I bet.
I was an Al-Anon ninja.
Sia, I know we're coming up on time. Dad, we don't know each other that well, but the little contact that we have had, I've really enjoyed. I love your work. I enjoy your work. I enjoy you and what you're doing in the world. People can find you on Twitter at Sia, the best handle ever, at S-I-A. Instagram is at Sia Music. Of course, I'll link to everything that we've discussed.
I occasionally tweet, but I don't really run any of those. They're more marketing things. You're being very nice. Thank you.
And I'm mentioning them. And also, you know, I just realized as I'm looking at my hands right now that I do know the difference between supine and prone, because when you're doing a chin up and your palms are facing you, that's supination, which you can remember because you could put soup in your hands to eat it with your palms up. And then when you have your hands facing down or away, that's pronation. So if you're lying on your stomach, that would be prone. And if you're laying on your back, that would be supine. Just to come full circle with the prone and supine.
I just love learning. I don't care if I'm wrong.
See, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we bring to a close this first conversation on the podcast?
No, I feel like we could talk for 7 hours.
I bet we could. We definitely could.
Thank you for all of the good things that you're bringing to the world. I really appreciate it. Really, really interesting and broad coverage of, you know, what's globally of importance, I guess. I appreciate what you do. Thank you. You're welcome.
I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking the time. So thank you once again.
Of course.
And hopefully once this pesky virus gets handled, we'll have a chance to actually spend time in person at some point.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I'll bring Dallas.
I would love it. I would love it. And to everybody listening, we will link to everything in the show notes, all of the resources, all of the concepts, the movie, certainly, all of the handles, everything you can imagine. We will link to in the show notes at tim.blog/podcast. As usual, you can just search SIA. It's very memorable, very easy to spell, S-I-A. And I would imagine almost every language. So you'll be able to find it at tim.blog. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Hey guys, this is Tim again. Just a few more things before you take off. Number one, this is 5 Bullet Friday. Do you want to get a short email from me? Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides a little morsel of fun before the weekend? And 5 Bullet Friday is a very short email where I share the coolest things I've found or that I've been pondering over the week. That could include favorite new albums that I've discovered. It could include gizmos and gadgets and all sorts of weird shit that I've somehow dug up in the world of the esoteric as I do. It could include favorite articles that I've read and that I've shared with my close friends, for instance. And it's very short. It's just a little tiny bite of goodness before you head off for the weekend. So if you want to receive that, check it out. Just go to 4hourworkweek.com. That's 4hourworkweek.com, all spelled out, and just drop in your email and you will get the very next one. And if you sign up, I hope you enjoy it. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. Small businesses have unique needs. A lot of you know this, I know this, and even with the uncertainty these days, one thing stands unchanged, and that is the importance of having the right people on your team. But hiring can be hard. It can be really expensive if you make mistakes, very painful if you get it wrong. I've certainly had that experience, and I'm not eager to repeat it, so I try to do as much upfront screening as possible. When your business is ready to make the next hire, LinkedIn Jobs can help you screen candidates with the hard and soft skills that you're looking for. They'll match your position with qualified members so that you can find the right person quickly. Using LinkedIn's active community of more than 690 million professionals worldwide, LinkedIn Jobs can help you find and hire the right person faster. So, when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/Tim. Again, that's linkedin.com/Tim to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by Thrive Market. Thrive Market saves me a ton of money, and it's perfect for these crazy times. Thrive Market is a membership-based site on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. You can regularly save 25 to 50% off of normal retail prices with member-only prices for anything you can imagine, really. Whether it's keto, paleo, gluten-free, vegan, whatever, you can sort by that. You can find all types of food. You can find supplements. You can find non-toxic home products, clean wine, dog food, just about anything. And let me give you a personal example of just how much you can save. So my last order, I ordered Primal Kitchen mayonnaise, which is made with avocado oil. It's delicious. Justin's almond butter. And the first was 25% off. The Justin's almond butter was 30% off. Rao's homemade marinara sauce, which is awesome, 26% off. All said and done, at the end of my shopping, I saved $39 on my order. So members, and I'm a member, can earn wholesale prices every day and save an average of $30 on each order. I'll come back to that. And through Thrive Gives, their one-on-one membership matching program, every paid Thrive Market membership is matched with a free one for a low-income family in need. So go to thrivemarket.com/Tim today to give Thrive Market a try. You can select the membership model that best fits your lifestyle. They have 1 month and 12-month membership options. Choose a free gift up to $22 in value when you join today and purchase the one-year membership. And just remember, Thrive Market membership is risk-free. You can take the first 30 days to decide if Thrive Market is right for you. If it's not, just cancel within those 30 days and get a full refund. This is what I offered my mom. So again, that's thrivemarket.com/Tim. By the way, my mom kept using it. thrivemarket.com/Tim. Check it out.